This is Melanie Roberts, and I'm at the Voices from the War, the Poetry of World War I event for Poet in the City on the 7th of May 2015 at Richmond Old Town Hall, which is part of their museum. I'm going to be talking to Mario Petrucci, who was the first poet to be resident with BBC Three and at the Imperial War Museum. His award-winning collections include Shrapnel and Sheets, 1996, and Flowers of Sulphur, 2007, as well as many other works. What I'd really like to know tonight is how you're going to approach these other voices.
Yes, the other voices. Of necessity, one has to sift culture, sift history. You can't look at it all. And the ages before us, the curricula before us, have made decisions about what they'd like to look at, what they consider the best of what's come out of the First World War and that best reminds us of our current attitudes to it, or perhaps addresses our shortcomings in that respect. But I don't always agree with those choices, and one shouldn't, of course. One should challenge history and historical history-making, historical decisions of that kind. And one of the things I really want to tease out this evening is a sense that a great deal of First World War poetry was actually quite banal. It was quite jingoistic and predictable in its form and in its thinking, and particularly in its language. And that I regard that as reflecting states of mind that would themselves lead people to have a habitual response to conflict, such as war is. It's a habit. It's a very bad habit we've got into. So that's really the central argument, that there was a sense of a way of thinking and speaking at one point, although that's fuzzy and you can challenge that notion. And then it changed in some respects, or did it, into another way of thinking and speaking in poetry, which you might call modernism or post-Georgian verse. But that's a very compromised idea because, of course, in many ways it hasn't changed altogether. We still very much have the attitudes and the tonalities of that way of speaking that there was in Georgian times in 1914. So really it's to flesh that out with examples and a sense of familiarity with the other voices that are usually left off the assessment because they're not strong, or because what they offer is perhaps in contradiction to what we would like to feel was the best of the First World War in its writing.
So who has really got your attention of those people that have slipped out of view?
Well, a lot of the women writers who are actually balanced in a very difficult way across writing poems, because their poetry wasn't always regarded in the highest esteem by mostly male editors. And also because what they were trying to talk about wasn't the conflict firsthand often, but the conflict second or third hand, experienced through loss or experienced through what you witness through the media, as it was then, the media, and so on. So I find their position often quite a tenuous, tricky, interesting one for those reasons.
Do you think they will come into view through this massive examination of this period in any lasting way, or are they always going to remain quite ephemeral?
Well, if we group together women and other excluded groups, I think they'll probably remain ephemeral, probably, because it's not as interesting to teach a sense of what was failing in literature and what didn't meet the requirements. It's probably more rousing to teach the Wilfred Owen poems and others that challenge and do so in very definite terms, which in its way is another kind of stereotyping of what war is about, but one that suits what we would like to think about war now.
Now, you said that you might have an example you would like to read onto the tape. So,
well, this is a poem by E.B. Flenley, written round about 1914, as far as I can make out. Mowing, mowing in the sunlight, on the windy lawn, mowing mid the wind and sunshine, mowing since the dawn. Mowing, mowing. And that's from a poem entitled Mowing. And then you compare that, for instance, with Isaac Rosenberg, who writes, and this is a poem, Marching as Seen from the Left File, just a couple of years later, 1915, 1916. My eyes catch ruddy necks, sturdily pressed back, all a red brick moving glint, like flaming pendulums, hands swing across the khaki, mustard-coloured khaki, to the automatic feet. just so much more modern, so much more concrete and real. And that's just one small example of many aspects of how literature shifted through the First World War and beyond into other ways of thinking through poetry, one of them being modernism, which we would loosely call modernism, that I'm very interested in.
I mean, when you were having your astonishing opportunity at the Imperial War Museum, did you have a particular focus when you were there on a war in particular or any aspect of war?
I didn't go there with an agenda. I was there in receptive mode as a sponge to try and absorb whatever came my way, whatever I stumbled across, because there's so much material. But also a sense of I wanted to know what it was like for them at that time. And that necessitated an awful lot of reading and looking at. Yes, so it was really to receive the signals that were still stored there, like pickles in vinegar, in the poems, in the images and so on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And good luck tonight.